I'm Dr. Howie Jacobson, and this is the Plant Yourself Podcast. Each week, I bring you a conversation with someone who's making a positive difference in the world. And for my day job, I help leaders and their teams master their mindsets so they can achieve great things. To find out more, check out the Mindset Mastery Memo, my Substack newsletter. You can find it at plantyourself.com/memo. And now, today's show. Hey, welcome to the Plant Yourself Podcast. I'm your host, Howard Jacobson. This is, I don't know exactly which episode it is because I'm doing this introduction live because I'm here in the lovely home and farm of Lee and Larry Newland of Peaceful River Farms of Southern Orange County, North Carolina. Welcome, Lee and Larry.
Thank you.
Glad to be here.
This is so much fun to do it live.
Oh, wow. That's kind of scary.
Well, it's not that live. No one's... If any of us curses, we can take that out of the editing floor. I do interviews with people all over the world, so it is such a treat to realize, I mean, what an incredible community of farmers and foodies and health nuts we have right here in our backyard. So I'd love to begin by just asking you guys, what's your story? How did you get to this gorgeous piece of land? How many acres is it?
18
acres. You've got beautiful gardens, crops coming up. Lee, you're a food educator and cooking teacher. A lot of people, I'm jealous, right? I'm sure a lot of other people want to know, like, how'd you get here? Did you grow up farming and foodieing, or what was the story?
Why don't you tell the story up to...
Okay. So we tell people that we're not from here, but we've come home because both of us have ancestral roots in the area. My grandfather was a the endow conservative Quaker who farmed about 7 miles, west of here in the Snow Camp area. Lee's great-grandfather was a circuit-riding Quaker minister turned circuit-riding Methodist minister who was educated at Sylvan Academy on the Cane Creek in Snow Camp. And we owned garden centers and landscape business for 20-some years in Greensboro. And in 2005, Lee developed non-Hodgkin's lymphoma and was determined not to have that repeat. And so she began really focusing on what are the healthy foods that she should be eating so that it did not come back. And that's when she really began to push forward with... a kitchen garden in our backyard in Greensboro and beginning to teach healthy cooking classes as she learned more and more and got her family and friends plugged into healthy cooking, then she wanted to share more about it. So take up the story.
Yeah, that was like a real bolt out of the sky to get a phone call at 6 p.m. on a Friday evening that what you thought was an ulcer was cancer. And I still am astounded that I could stand after I was told that. I thought I was feeding my family and myself beautifully, but...
So what was your diet like at that point?
Well, it was get whatever you could get to the table because we were working 10 hours a day at least. We had two teenagers, and it was a really hectic life, very stressful. So I was really shocked that I had gotten sick. And that night, I'll never forget it. We didn't cry. We didn't... fall apart. We do this when we have problems. We just, let's go after this. And so we went to the doctor the very next day. He had it was open in the morning, and he said, "Yes, you do have cancer." And I said, "Is there any chance for me?" He said, "There's always a chance." And I'll never forget those words. So that's where it all started. And going through chemo was probably the hardest thing I've ever done in my life. Physically, mentally, emotionally, every way possible. And I thought, okay, this cannot happen again. I cannot let this happen again. So I was in the hospital suffering from pneumocystis as a result of chemo, which is common. And so I just turned to the nurse and I said, okay, can you give me something to read about how to beat cancer? And she handed me this book. It's Dr. Mitchell Gaynor's Cancer Prevention Program. It's out of print. You can't find it. And if you do, congratulations. But it's a book that I picked up and I read it the entire night that I was in the hospital, and it gave me the answers about how the correlation between what you're eating, how you're living your life, your lifestyle has a direct influence on how you can tackle cancer. And it empowered me, it gave me hope, and that's where it all started. And I tried so hard to get a hold of him to let him know what he had done for my life, but I thought, you know, I'll just let him go, leave him alone. But it was quite a journey. And then to learn on my own what you can do to really boost your immune system to make it possible for you to defend yourself, because cancer is just about everywhere, and we even have some in our body, but it's not going to come out unless you give it the chance to. And then I realized then how important it was what we were eating. And the message that I was trying to get through to my family was that we've got to change the way we eat. No more fast food, no more catches and catch can, nothing out of a box, and let's start thinking about what can these foods do for us. So that's where I began, and they got pretty tired of me preaching, and then my friends got pretty tired of me preaching about how you need to eat better, and I said, well, by golly, I'm going to start teaching. And so I did, and I started with a group here from Chapel Hill. It was a group that wanted to come see our hydrangeas in our garden, and I tricked them. I said, why don't you come and have lunch, and we'll talk a little bit about what we're eating. And it was really exciting, and it was like I had this hand on my shoulder saying, this is what you're supposed to be doing. I had a lot of moments like that that were really boosting me forward and saying, you can do this even though you feel like you can't.
So you read the book, I assume, while you were still undergoing chemo or shortly thereafter.
Yes.
When did you know that the diet was working?
Oh, my. I guess when I got that wonderful report and on April 13th, 2005, that I was cancer free. And it was like a priceless gift that had been given. And I said, you are going to protect this, and this is not going to happen again. So at that point is when I really started a whole new way of living and a whole new way of learning about those foods that can really make a difference. And it was really exciting. It still is. I get so turned on whenever I see the correlation between a specific group of foods, or not just one food, because it takes a lot of foods to really make that difference. But when you learn something exciting like that, you want to share it. You want people to know this.
And then with the checkups that you're having with your oncologist, the blood work would always come back essentially perfect, and he was always, you know, captivated by how well she was doing, and you know, and finally said no more CAT scans and that sort of thing. So he felt comfortable enough with how all that was looking that he didn't feel like she needed to keep going through that process. So she now just has an annual, you know, touch base and do the blood work and stuff like that. So 10 years later.
I'm curious at how open you were to this information, because you know, a lot more people get cancer every year than think that they can do anything about it, right? We're programmed to think that cancer is a lottery. It's genetic or something in your environment, and there's nothing you can do about it except follow the medical paradigm and do whatever they tell you, and then just hope for the best. What made you open to the idea that it was in your hands to prevent this from happening again and to get better?
Well, I think both Larry and I have always been learners. We like to learn, and we like to know that there's a better way. Mm-hmm. And the fear that I had suffered at first about how in the world did this happen turned into those stages, like fear and anger and sadness, all those stages you do go through. And then I said, you have to take charge of your body, and you're going to have to find your answer. You're going to have to do that. I mean, is that kind of what you're wanting to know?
Sure. I don't know what I'm wanting to know. I'm just always curious when people take the path less traveled, you know, the path that takes more courage, the path of self-responsibility.
I think on two or three occasions during our married years, Lee has taken on things where she knew very little about it starting out, but then just immersed herself in reading everything she can and going to conferences and going to workshops and the like. And one was Golden Retriever Rescue, where she was spending up to 3 or 4 hours a night helping to do intake for rescue Goldens. And another was when she stepped in as our garden center manager in the garden centers we owned and learned everything she could about horticulture, about managing people and stuff like that. So I think she goes at these new projects, these new frontiers with abandon and networks. She's not afraid to call some expert up and say, tell me about X, Y, Z. And so, you know, I think that that's part of maybe an unusual trait that you won't find in every person. But I think we've seen a lot of people come through her classes who catch the bug and start investigating more. Don't take things at face. You know, I'm not going to die tomorrow. I'm going to do everything I can to prevent that. We've had some folks really pretty much in critical condition come to our healthy eating classes, and they call up a year later and say, you've changed my life. You know, not to say that it's all her, but it, you know, it gets them on that path of self-discovery and what they can do, I think.
Yeah, I really like to plant a seed and get people starting to think and have the courage and the strength that they can do it, and they either can survive cancer or give it a good try to try to save yourself. I mean, I just can't even imagine not fighting something that you've got such control over. You really do, and I do believe that. I know I'm probably a little different from most people, but I don't want to have a doctor come and take my hand and go, now listen, you're going to get through that chemo just fine. I'm going to pat your hand and I'm going to let you feel like I'm the person that makes all the decisions and you can eat anything you want. You're going to be just fine. Let's just get through the chemo. It's going to be hard, but this is what you're going to have to do. And I just would not do that. And I remember when I had to go on a medicine to keep my blood thin called
Coumadin.
And I went marching into my doctor's office and I said, with my hands on my hips, I said, I am not giving up greens just because I'm learning that you're not supposed to be eating greens while taking this medicine. And he said, good for you. He said, we'll get your Coumadin levels regulated. You can eat all the greens you want, but we have to be consistent. I said, deal. And that's how it worked back then when I had issues with my blood from the chemo. And I just remember how I was surprised at how I acted, but I also wasn't surprised that I wanted to live and I wanted to continue a life that I love and feel so grateful to have. I remember a moment whenever I was going through chemo and I would have this regimen and I'd go to the bathroom, get ready for bed, and I'd have to look in this great big mirror of a woman that I didn't know who it was, with no hair, sunken eyes, and looking really, really sad. And I remember going to bed one night and I just started to cry. And I had this hand, it felt like a hand was on my head. And ever since that happened, I felt loved and supported and cared for by a power that much greater than we could ever be. And that really it moved me. And I thought, you can do this. And I did it.
I'm struck by a couple of things in that story. First of all, this may sound insensitive from coming from me, but the gift of your cancer has given you so much credibility and so much empathy with the people that you're helping now. That, you know, if you had just come to one day and said, you know, I want to teach people healthy cooking,
yeah,
it would be very different with you had you not had that experience. And the second thing is, you know, you talked about everyone has cancer inside them, and then kind of, I think everyone has seeds of self-responsibility inside them too. And it sounds like, you know, we get to choose which ones to water. And it sounds like what you're doing is showing people by example what happens when you water the seeds of self-responsibility.
That's a good analogy.
And the interesting thing, because you can really get overwhelmed kind of in this cancer treatment center where people from all over the world are coming and it's packed to the hilt with folks. You can get overwhelmed with that, but you also recognize that the cutting edge of that research is building up immune systems, and whether you do that through some new technology, drug or what have you, or whether you do that through the food that you consume, I think that that's the wave of where cancer treatment and probably, you know, you name it, cardiovascular disease, diabetes, whatever diseases, that's where folks are beginning to turn, both the experts and the folks who are going through it. You know, we need to build up our immune system and let the good fellas attack the bad fellas, or turn things around in our body through the right stoking the fires the correct way through nutrition, you know. So
You probably don't want to put this on here, but I'm going to tell you this anyway.
Well, say it loud just in case we do.
I remember right before having to start chemo, I was lying in bed, and it was like, I think, 2 days after my birthday, and I had to start chemo on that Monday. So I was lying there, and I had my hands on my heart and my liver and my kidneys, my pancreas, my stomach, everything. And I started talking to my body, and I apologized for allowing this to happen. I said, we're really going to have to go through something really rough. And I really thought I'd lost my mind when I started doing that. But then I thought, this is what you have to do. You've got to connect with your body. And I remember how I gathered a lot of strength by doing that. And I don't tell too many people that I've done that, but it made me feel connected and responsible for my health. And it was a great feeling to say you're sorry for putting your body into this position, but we're going to all fight together and try to get through this. And we did.
Well, that's a beautiful story. I don't know if you know the book Radical Remission. It's by a researcher named Kelly Turner, who studied 1,000 people who recovered from cancers that the doctors said they weren't going to recover from. Mm. And she lists 9 commonalities that all of them have. One is about eating better, one is judicious use of supplementation, but most of them are about mental state, about emotions, about, you know, dealing with whatever negative emotions had been there, changing lifestyle, embracing positive emotions, and embracing some degree of connection with something bigger, whether they called it God or divinity or nature. Mm-hmm. So I'm not surprised to hear it. Mm. But I think it's also why our studies of cancer survivors consist of case reports of 1,000 people rather than millions, because I think it's possible for most. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So while we're talking about seeds, I want to come back to the garden, because we're in this gorgeous farm. So when you were running the garden centers, I'm imagining, when I think of garden centers, that they're usually pretty different from sort of sustainable, organic farming.
Right.
So tell me about the garden center and how it differs from like what you're doing now.
Well, we were pretty high traffic, high volume retail locations in Greensboro, and so for us it was like 70-80 hour weeks, and we were going at it really hard personally, and being a very seasonal business, you know, spring was just crazy. I remember one time we took a trip in early spring and came back and said, we'll see you again in June, you know, it's a married couple here.
To each other.
Yeah, to each other. We did sell synthetic chemicals, we did sell synthetic fertilizers, but we were, by the time we sold our interest in the garden centers, we had folks working with us, and we're beginning to get into some seminars and workshops where organic made more sense to us. And so we were really pushing lines of alternative pest control as well as organic fertilizers. Didn't really capture the whole thing about soil health and what exactly we were doing, but just knew that that it was a better alternative than the synthetic fertilizers and chemicals that we were selling. Once we sold our interest in the garden centers, we I went on the wholesale nursery end of things, and then that was even more of a shock because there was a lot of pesticide use in the wholesale nurseries that we that I'm selling for, and you know, you'd see the caution signs, don't enter this location and the like.
And was that for food crops as well?
It was, there were a few herbs.
Uh-oh, my bad, the phone's ringing. Now everybody knows my ringtone is Van Morrison.
there were a few herbs, but for the most part, no, they were pretty much ornamental horticulture. And then simultaneously, we began this garden tour business, Lee and I did, and we were taking people on tours of England and Italy and Pacific Northwest and New Orleans and Charleston and Hudson Valley and the like. And increasingly, we were drawn to what the British call productive gardening, the edible landscape, the kitchen garden, whatever, that had great aesthetic to it, nice color, nice textures, but it was there to be enjoyed and eaten. And you know, a lot of those were historic gardens that that were rehabilitated or rediscovered archaeologically, that had been abandoned. And we were drawn in our own design of our backyard kitchen garden in Greensboro to that aesthetic, to try to create, you know, grass paths so that it'd be easy for our guests to walk in, but also easy for us to seed, harvest, weed, whatever. And from there, we started getting more into organic gardening workshops, conferences. Our farm coach, who helped us evaluate property when we got into the farm searching mode, was the speaker at one Sunday afternoon, I remember, in Durham, that really, really got us the bug turned on that we really wanted to do this. And so for us, it was a combination of looking for property that would have some aesthetic to it. And in this case, we really were fortunate because it just had a natural beauty to it, rolling hills and being on the river and everything. Nice soil, silty clay. Yeah, and our farm coach stated what we were thinking. This place is filled with nature, and it speaks to me, and it was speaking to us as well. Particularly as we headed down to the river and just sort of spent a Sunday afternoon of decision making when the negatives were outweighing the pros about whether or not to buy this property. It was that sentimental tug that kind of got us over the edge. So in developing the farm, we had a number of things in mind. We wanted to grow the superfoods, the really nutrient-dense foods that we could tout in our classes, and folks could bring home produce boxes with the classes. We were looking for an aesthetic. We wanted to lay the farm out so that it would be visually appealing to us and to our guests and to folks who come to class or farm dinners. And we really had a strong pull to protect the river and to enhance the soil that we were on, not only so that we could grow healthy food, but that we would leave this a better place than.
And we're on the Haw River,
which
I believe was a few years ago called one of the most polluted rivers in America.
Dead nature is what the UNC botanist phrased it in the early 70s. Said he'd never seen dead nature before. The textile pollution, 26 mills. Had located throughout the centuries on the Haw, and some of those turned into, you know, multinational textile manufacturing and denim manufacturing facilities that really just dumped their waste into the Haw. The agricultural runoff was severe, and then in addition, suburbanization. So by the 70s, it was really in very foul shape. It was really the demise of the textile industry coupled with real strong efforts on the part of the Haw River Assembly, Triangle Land Conservancy, Piedmont Land Conservancy, a number of county and state initiatives that has helped the Haw come back to life. So there's now an eagle nesting a couple, 3 miles down the river. There are otters that have come back. The number of signs of health for the river. So we don't want to screw that up, you know. And it's not just the river. It's Jordan Lake, Cape Fear River, the Atlantic Ocean. All those are connected. And so we pollute the Haw, and we end up polluting a lot more downstream. And the downstream metaphor is one that we take seriously. It's downstream for the next generations. We'd love for our children to inherit this property, and so we really do want to make it a better place for them than what we found it.
So what are some of the specifics that you saw on your world tours of productive gardens that you wanted to bring here? You mentioned the grass paths, but what are some of the principles, these historic archaeological gardens had that maybe we've lost as suburban gardeners or large-scale farmers in this country?
There were two in England that I recall. One was now called the Lost Gardens of Heligan, which was an Edwardian plantation, and it had twin market gardens that are still worked by hand. They don't do tilling or anything. Everything would be with broad forks or other handwork to get the beds prepared. So minimum tillage would be one thing. You know, obviously centuries ago they wouldn't have had automatic tillers, but disturbing the land as little as possible. Ford Abbey in Devon, England, was very similar. Beautiful kitchen gardens that took over about 2 acres, and again, things were still done by hand in the 21st century, just to not only carry on the tradition but to help build soil health and the like. Lots of composting, organic matter being added, and then the crop rotation, they were following that, eons ago. I mean, that all those kind of principles that are now part of the Organic Practices Act were followed back then. Certainly, the proximity, there weren't like, it wasn't the farm, 2 miles down the road kind of thing, and you lived here, and it was right in their own backyard.
And so, sometimes in the front yard.
Yeah, and so the productive garden literally was a kitchen garden. It was something that would be near, the kitchen was a separate building. It'd be something near there, or it'd be something near the primary residence, so that they could smell it, they could see it, they were, touching distance of the food that they brought to the table.
I just want to interject that they also were beautiful gardens. The vegetables were stunning. They were succulent. You wanted to just snap them right off and take them inside and prepare them. That to me was so inspirational, to see how beautifully incorporated into the landscape the vegetables and fruits were. And it wasn't perfect. I'm not talking about a perfect garden. It was just one that was so inspiring to go back. And I'm in love with vegetable gardens. I have been for decades. I think they're gorgeous. And they're just everything I want out of a garden.
And I think the other thing that they were pretty sharp in various places, even here in America in colonial days, of creating microclimates where you could have season extension, whether that was a south-facing stone wall that would help heat the garden up so you get things planted earlier, or the right facing from a wind and sun situation like at Monticello. The notion of having some cold frames, like there was a pineapple production at Heligan. So a number of things that we now think we're plowing new ground by putting up high tunnels or low tunnels or cold frames and the like, all these have been done for centuries, really.
Mm-hmm. It's, interesting to think about, there's some, a lot of the young farmers now sort of getting into this, and so they're buying plots of land or renting, and you can see kind of the older farmers are looking at them, like all this newfangled stuff, this crazy stuff they're getting from, food soil web and all these, of course we have to plow every year. What is this no-tillage stuff? And yet our modern agriculture is really only like 60 years old.
That's right.
And these gardens have been productive, have proven themselves, in a sort of Darwinian fashion over sometimes centuries.
And I think we have some friends who were conventional tobacco farmers in eastern North Carolina, and they switched over to organic because it was do or die. The tobacco went down the tubes, and then they were doing crop, where you're at the mercy of the broker to say what he was going to pay you that day, and sometimes you're better plowing the field under than harvesting anything. Mm-hmm. And it was really becoming certified organic farmers that allowed them to have the profit margins to keep them going. I asked one fella near Edenton, why did they get into organic grain farming? He says, because we wanted to continue to farm. All the farms that my father was a manager at ended up going under. So we wanted to figure out the strategy from a profitability standpoint to be able to do it. And then we understood the rest of the practical aspects of organic farming and bought into it. But it was really just survival that started out that way. You know?
I read an article recently, I think it might have been on grist.org, about looking at the sort of the biggest industries in the world and which ones would actually be profitable if you factored in the pollution, the health costs, all the externalities, and they couldn't find one. You know, they're sort of going down the line from like shipping to agriculture to energy to infrastructure to building. There was nothing.
Right.
And I think you might have to come all the way down to small-scale market gardening before you start finding industries that are truly profitable.
And I think that's the trend. We've seen this dramatic loss in farms. I was remembering, you know, in probably grade school or middle school, the statistics about how many farms there were in the 20s and turn of the century and how everyone went to the cities and we lost all these farms. But that has just continued. I mean, we've had 100,000 farms in North Carolina in the 70s, and now we have something like 48,000. So we've cut it again by 50%. And you look at how unsustainable that trajectory is, and you look at what's happening in California and go, you know, does it make sense for us to be bringing food 3,000 miles that we can grow here in North Carolina when they're having, you know, obvious mega problems in California and the Southwest? So if we're going to eat, we need to figure out a new paradigm. And it's evolving from the ground up. This area is filled with young farmers or wannabe farmers who are going to Central Carolina Sustainable Ag Program or attending conferences at Carolina Farm Stewardship that are being mentored by other farmers and wanting to find somebody that they can get a small parcel of their land to start farming. And so we actually have an increase here in the triangle in the number of farms, not in the drop off of farmland loss, but the number of new farms is actually on the increase, which is a good sign. And certainly when you look at farmers markets where people are elbow to elbow, that's a good sign. When you look at the increase in local and sustainable food on the produce shelves at almost any grocery store now, and the rise of the co-op stores and the niche grocery stores, then I think all that's good signs. It's just how do we encourage, incentivize these young folks and even a number of folks about our age who are wanting to, you know, second, third career folks to get into it.
Oh, that's us.
Yeah.
I'm turning 50 and that's all I want to do.
Yeah.
So podcast and farm.
Yeah, there you go. So, and a number of folks on last week's farm tour were retirees actually who would come and now have 5, 10, 15 acres that they're plugging into. So the trajectory is now switching and we're seeing the possibility that we can turn around an unsustainable food system. And, you know, we need it ground up, we need it top down, we need it every which way for this to work out. And we need, you know, what 50% of your plate is supposed to be vegetables and berries, and yet 1% of our USDA subsidies.
50?
At least 50%. According to the USDA, 50% of your smart plate or whatever, the my plate thing, this should be vegetables.
Well, I don't agree.
And you would say 100% or 90%, but according to USDA, but USDA doesn't put their money where their mouth is. It goes to soybean and corn and sugar and everything else. So they're not incentivizing vegetable and berry growing, you know, is kind of the point I was trying to make before I was so rudely interrupted.
Oh,
yeah. Well, and recently I interviewed a woman named Amy Hamlin, who I think is going to be, by the time people hear this, she'll have been posted. She just founded the New York Coalition for Healthy School Lunches.
Oh, cool.
And talked about, here's the USDA telling us what our kids should be eating, and here's what's getting subsidized, right? The milk, the tater tots, and, you know, like, what, just when you look at the question, like, what kind of civilization is, like, actively poisoning its young people?
Right.
You know, you see the crazy disconnect between what we know and what gets written into law and statute.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you mentioned when you were doing your garden centers, you really didn't know much about the sort of soil health. And that's kind of where I entered the whole gardening world. I wasn't a gardener growing up. It was itchy. I didn't get it. Even in my 40s, I was like, my wife was always into it, and I would be like dragged out to help her, but I just wanted to get back inside as quickly as possible. And then when I was working on Hole with Dr. Campbell, these concentric circles of holism. So it's like, it's not just the nutrients, it's the whole foods, it's not pills, it's the entire, it's not just individual superfoods, it's the entire dietary pattern. And at the same time, I started reading about soil health. The first book was Gaia's Garden.
Oh, yeah.
By Toby Hemingway, about permaculture.
Yeah.
And it suddenly hit me that you could have the conversation about food and the conversation about farming, the conversation about individual health and the conversation about soil health, about ecological health. They're the same conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you probably came to that much earlier and deeper than I did. I'd love to hear your thoughts on just that whole thing.
So I think most folks think about soil health as how do you get as many earthworms in the ground as possible, but it's really a new frontier of scientific study to learn more about the microbiota in the soil and how they interact and what we do when we do till or disturb the soil that starts us back to ground zero. So truly healthy soil has something like 6 to 8 billion microbiota per tablespoonful, which is a pretty incredible number. My soil science instructor at Central Carolina was in grad school, and the fellow said that, that's physically impossible to be able to put 6 to 8 billion anything in a tablespoonful. So she bet him a case of beer, and somehow or another they won. I don't think they counted 6 to 8 billion microbiota, but they figured out through their calculations that it was possible if you look at the size of some of these fungi and bacteria that they're discovering. So the bacteria are essentially the glue of our soil web, and the fungi are the building blocks, and the two interact really important in an important way. And the research now that's coming out, and I haven't incorporated a lot of these principles yet, but we could be getting away from having to change the pH in our soil through liming. We could be getting away from even using natural fertilizers to supplement the soil. If we got that sweet spot, and knowing from crop to crop what the fungi and bacteria look like by using microscopes to study the particular soil that we're looking to grow things in, we could, if we got that all perfectly balanced, we could be eliminating a lot of our gardening practices, not just tilling, but a lot of other gardening practices that we're currently doing by a real focus on that soil life that's happening. So I think increasingly you're going to see young sustainable farmers become more scientists, or at least microbiologists, than is currently the case. So I don't know enough. I think it's an emerging field, but it's things that the Natural Resource Conservation Service is beginning to embrace, and that we're going to see more studies done, more research done, and more practical applications of how do we protect and enhance that soil life so that is the balancing act that will make our vegetables less likely to have pathogens, less likely to have insects, be more nutritious and the like. We know from folks looking at USDA data that the amount of nutrients in most of our produce, or at least some number of our produce that they've studied, has actually declined from all the things that we've done to make sure that it would store well, that it would ship 3,000 miles, that it would have all the properties that we need for the kind of food system that we have. So I think as we look more towards seeds and plants that are primarily nutritious and tasty, then we're going to get back to a system that makes a lot more sense than worrying about whether or not it ships 3,000 miles.
Mm-hmm. And I guess that, what I learned about gardening, sort of conventional gardening, is that the three things you need to watch out for are like nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium. And of course, you can get that in big bags of granules, and you can mix it in your sprayer, and it's very easy. You can just do a little soil test, you can do a little pH test, and just amend with those basic nutrients, which reminds me a lot of like reading food labels and the way we're taught, well, you need, you know, oranges have vitamin C, or, you know, if you want to see well, you need vitamin A, so eat your carrots. And it's, the problem is not just that it's simplistic, it's that when you're thinking in such fragmented terms, you're always going to create an imbalance. The human beings are not smart enough, no matter how good we are at science, we're not smart enough to outsmart nature. And that real, real scientific advance comes from learning how nature works and mimicking and trying to get along, rather than saying, well, our big brains can take, can turn these, you know, the vast grassland prairies of America into food monocultures. Mm-hmm. Into, you know, you talked about the beauty of the garden. I don't think anyone would go to a field of soybeans and say, wow, that's really beautiful. You know, I feel at home here. I can hear the, no, that wasn't a bird. That was a crop dusting plant.
Yeah.
So I'm curious, what do you see as the links between taking care of the soil to grow healthy food and taking care of the body?
Well, what was the Carl Sagan comment about billions and billions of stars? I mean, if you listen to a Dr. Oz or whoever, there are billions and billions of cells in our body and billions of microbiota in the soil. And you know more about the pH issues related to health, but you know, we're interested in pH both in our bodies and in the soil, and we're interested in the kind of balance that you're just mentioning. What thoughts do you have?
I just want to keep it simple. Just eat real whole food. I mean, to me, we've got to make it simple for them to believe and grasp and do. So, and you've got to make it taste great. So that's really where my philosophy is. Just get to the people, show them how to cook if they don't know how to cook, or if they're cooking, enhance those skills and help them choose the right foods to use. And go to your farmer's market to get the foods, for heaven's sake, and not to a grocery store that's shipping it, you know, thousands of miles away. I mean, alkalinity and acidity, you know, there is a balance. But I think if you're eating correctly, doesn't that all seem to kind of work out?
In my experience, it mostly does.
Yeah.
You know, you talked about the future of cancer medicine is building immunity. I think about the future of food as not destroying our immunity.
Mm-hmm. You know, kidding.
It's not like you have to, you know, like we didn't have to come here to America in the 16th century and build soil, mm-hmm. right? We came here and we depleted it for 500 years, and now we're trying to figure out how to save what we've got and start building more.
Yeah.
I think most people are born with immunity, especially, you know, if it's a natural birth and they're breastfed, like we've got immunity.
Mm-hmm.
And we can eat foods that support it and enhance it and maintain it. But you know, I think about this, the whole food plant-based diet is like people can recover so dramatically and so rapidly and from so many things. It's like if you just stop hitting yourself over the head with a hammer, like amazing things happen quickly.
Yeah.
And it's just, and when you go through that, you're forever changed. When you see this is the right path to go down, and I'm not going back this way. In fact, that path just keeps leading to more wonderful paths, and this change and this evolution of who you are and what you're going to be and what you can do with good health. It's just such a gift to get it. And I'm always turned on and excited about all the new things that we're learning to make that path a little easier. Mm. And definitely tasteful.
So you had your epiphany when your kids were teenagers, and you said people got tired of listening to you preach. What were your strategies that worked and maybe some that didn't work around getting your kids to eat healthy? And you mentioned you have a grandchild now. How has the legacy project been? Do they listen to you?
Isn't that funny that you're saying that? Because I'm sitting there thinking about my children had grown up and they were out of the house when I got sick. They were just beginning into their careers. But my son-in-law, Steve Brown, was the one that really triggered a lot of this because he became a vegetarian the same year that I'd gotten sick. So when they would come over for Sunday meals, every Sunday they would come and we would go out to our big porch and have a beautiful meal. I slowly started, instead of just cooking for Steve, I said, this is ridiculous, we're all supposed to be eating like this. And so we all ate vegetarian. And on what came, I mean, what happened on those Sundays spilled over into Mondays and Tuesdays and Wednesdays and Thursdays and so on and on. And so we just started eating a plant-based diet, thanks to him. And now I have 1, 2, 3, 4 children, two of which they're married to, but I consider them mine and ours. They're mostly vegan. And they're raising a 2-year-old that's vegan. And she's as healthy as you can imagine. And I'm so tickled that I've really kind of watched them take this and go much further than I ever expected. And I think when I'm trying to influence other folks outside of my family, I really feel like it's important to be real and to be approachable and encouraging and definitely have some humor in what you're doing, because nobody likes to be lectured to and told, you know, you really need to stop doing that and do this. I try to make our classes a lot of fun, full of really good information about how to make to get those meals on the table quicker with the right kinds of foods.
Mm-hmm. So Lee's not saying this directly, but she really is a great cook, and I think our kids realize that, you know, nutritious and delicious can go together. So our older daughter Meredith is now bringing collard roll-ups whenever we say bring something for our Easter dinner or whatever. I think there is that push on their part to try to come up with dishes or to find the right recipes or whatever that will be really tasty and follow all the kind of things that they want to make sure that in the case of Meredith and Catherine, their child is consuming and that they're consuming. So I think it's more than just buying into it. They're really looking for being good cooks as well, I think. You know?
They are, and it's just like, I just watch them and think, let them inspire me, because they are. Mm. And that, it's a miracle.
So when you were working 70 to 80 hour weeks and just what catches catch can, did you know how to cook at that point? You just didn't have time.
Oh yeah, oh yeah, fried chicken and pound cakes. And I'm exaggerating. I never had time to do any of that stuff. But yeah, I felt like everything we cooked was pretty tasty. But it was really using I wasn't using it as enough vegetables. And my dad really influenced me as a cook. He was a Navy cook, and he always said, "Now Lee, whatever you do, make sure everything is low and slow. Cook it on low and don't cook it any more than you have to. Make sure you're slow cooking." And I keep hearing him. We lost him a couple years ago and we really miss him. He's a big part of our lives, but he left a lot of impact. He impacted me greatly. And my grandchildren, and his grandchildren, my children. But I think fun should be cooking should be fun. One of my best memories about Dad is going out into our first crop of the year. We just moved here, and I picked him some collards, and he came in and cooked them, and it was just a great moment. It's a picture of him on my website, cooking those collards. Just a sweet, sweet picture of him. Mm. He's a great man.
So I know a lot of people. It sounds like you were an accomplished cook with a certain genre of food, even though you didn't have time to do it. Like you knew your way around a kitchen, you had a family legacy. I know a lot of people who identify as good cooks, and then they have a health scare or they start discovering this information, and it's really hard for them
to
be a beginner again.
Yeah.
What was it like for you to learn how to cook
It was exciting.
Plant-based foods.
Oh my gosh, when I discovered a Vitamix, and I discovered nut butters that you can make at home, and coffee creamer out of nuts, and what you could do with kale, and what you could do with collards, and all these great exciting recipes like beet hummus. All these things started, oh, they were so exciting.
So where did you look?
Oh, golly.
Who were your inspirations? Were you just figured out yourself, or did you?
Well, you had, even before all this, you had Diet for a Small Planet and mostly cookbook.
Yeah, Frances Moore LePage.
Uh-huh. And, and, you know, go look at her cookbook shelving now, and it's like, you know, about pull down the wall that she's got a bunch of books of all shades and stripes that you plow through all of that when you're creating your recipes.
Because there's parameters for me of what I can use and what I can't. And what I've learned over the years, and I'm trying to teach other folks to do that, is how do you substitute one food for the other? One that's not so good with something that's really good and that can help address any allergy you may have, or you're just wanting to get more nutrition. And that's what I look at, is what are those foods that are the best ones to choose, and how do I cook them so they taste wonderful? Like beet lemonade, for heaven's sake, have you ever heard of anything as weird as that?
No, that's
well, our chef, Kate Smith, for our farm dinners, she has made this amazing beverage that we introduced at our first farm dinner, and it was hilarious because they loved it. People that were going, okay, beet lemonade, yeah, I bet I'm gonna love that. You know, being sarcastic. And this guy was drinking 3 cups of it. And I said, you need to slow down. It was wonderful to see that excitement over something as awful sounding as beet lemonade. And it was delicious. You know, the natural sweetness of beets, that beautiful, vibrant color that signals nutrition, and then enhancing it with other things like mint and lemon. And I can't remember all she put in there. It's just an exciting beverage. But to look at food like that.
And you did spend a week up at the Culinary Institute of America with our younger daughter, Catherine, but those kind of experiences aren't like seminal, I don't think. I mean, it may have helped a technique or two or learn a few things, but I don't think.
It made both of us realize how strong we were, because that was really a rigorous time when we took that class. It's called The Techniques of Healthy Cooking.
Mm-hmm.
And looking back on it, I'd like to go right back up there and teach them how they should have taught that class. Because they were not using as many of the foods that I do currently, you know, the straight whole foods instead of adding all this other stuff to it.
Well, people can come down here for that class.
Wouldn't that be nice?
And I would also say whenever we travel, we almost always are searching for a restaurant that's focused on local and has a reputation, and then maybe they've got a cookbook out or something like that. So we try to hit those, and you'll steal an idea or two from those experiences, and that's usually the case.
I wouldn't call it stealing. I would call it being inspired.
Go talk to the chef for 30 minutes.
I do. I'll go back in the kitchen. I will. And they've invited me back, and I love to see what they're doing and how they're handling their food and what they've chosen. It's really exciting. I'm pretty aggressive. I'm sorry.
So I'm curious, Larry, about your experience when the diet was transitioning. You're a loving husband. You wanted to support your wife and your healing journey. Were there any points at which you were like, God, I need to just run out and get a bucket of chicken?
Or Cheetos.
During that period after we sold the garden centers, I was on the road a good bit calling on independent garden centers. And your great supportive husband when I was out of sight, you know. I mean, I would hit some snacks and stuff like that, but I always enjoy what you fix at home, and when we'd eat out, I generally would try to find as healthy a selection as possible. Not always, but usually. So, I wasn't an A+ husband in that regard, but not too bad either.
You were great.
So we just were interrupted for a second. A lot of life going on. There's a working farm, lots of things going on. So I don't want to take up any more of your time, but I'm sort of curious, just as a sort of a wrap up. You have advice for people who want to start growing their own food, and maybe they don't have 18 acres and maybe they don't have a lot of time, but is this dream available at some scale to most people?
I think definitely. So we have right in back of us a demonstration garden of about 1,200 square feet that the Kitchen Garden magazine editor had a similar size garden and found that offset his family budget by $4,000, just replacing what he'd normally get at the grocery store. And we hear a lot about income inequality and how folks haven't gotten a raise and this, that, and the other. So it could be, if it wasn't nutrition oriented, if it wasn't wanting to get your children and grandchildren involved, it could be just a matter of pocketbook issues of just wanting to grow your own food so that you'd have a little bit less dent in your family budget by shopping at the grocery store and eating at restaurants all the time. There are any number of really good books out there that talk about how to grow. Square Foot Gardening is an excellent book.
Matthew Bartholomew.
Yeah. Pamela Dalling has a book on market gardening, which applies to vegetable gardeners as well as farmers for folks who are in the South. It's more of a southern-oriented book. Elliot Coleman, the organic farming guru from New England, has a book. So there are any number of ways to get further up the learning curve. If you're in this area, Carolina Farm Stewardship Association covers North Carolina and South Carolina, and there are those kinds of associations in almost every state that have annual conferences that are good for farmers as well as gardeners. And website.
Yeah, and they have a website.
Oh, they have a website. Okay. I'm sorry.
We'll find it. I'm going to put links to everything.
Okay,
and,
cool.
And with your permission, I'll take some photos of kitchen garden so people can see what we're talking about.
Yeah. And the other thing that just on that, I mentioned children and grandchildren, but studies have shown that children who are actively engaged, whether it's their school garden or their community garden or neighborhood garden or garden in their own backyard, if they're actively engaged in growing, then they will also eat it. So if you're interested in them eating more carrots, have them grow carrots, they'll find out that carrots don't taste like cardboard. They're actually sweet and wonderful. And if they see a bug or something having eaten their bok choy, they won't freak out over it. They'll eat holy bok choy as well as perfectly raised bok choy. And it helps them become better connected with what they eat so that they will eat more good stuff.
Well, Lee and Larry Newlands, thank you so much. This has been a pleasure and an honor. I've been walking around the property just feeling incredibly inspired and nourished. And I haven't even tasted a bite of your food yet.
We've got to make that happen.
Yeah.
All right. It's on tape.
Can your listeners know about our website?
Please.
Okay. It's peacefulriverfarm.com.
Okay.
And we also are on Facebook, Peaceful River Farm, as well as Lee's Healthy Cooking. And we have upcoming classes as well as farm dinners, and we would love to have you.
All right. So if you're anywhere in driving distance of Orange County, Chapel Hill, North Carolina, you can go to the website, peacefulriverfarm.com, sign up for a dinner. You have some recipes on the website as well.
Yes, we do.
Is beet lemonade on there?
No, that's a secret.
That's a secret. All right, you got to come and taste it for yourself.
That's right.
And then come into the kitchen and talk to Lee for 45 minutes and maybe you can drag it out of her. So it's a beautiful website, and your guys' story is so inspiring. And again, thank you so much for everything you do in the world.
Thank you for inviting us.
I hope you enjoyed that interview as much as I did. Upcoming shows. Next week, I'm speaking with Carrie Saunders, who is a psychologist who works with people with food addictions and with food cravings. A lot of what we talked about was new to me and extremely helpful. The following week, I speak with Robert Ostfeld, who is a cardiologist in practice in the Bronx, New York, and who has been treating not just individual patients, but an entire community, and a community of not very wealthy people, to say the least, using plant-based nutrition and protocols with remarkable success. It's a great story.
And the following week, I speak with Corey Rennell, who is the founder of Core Foods, a produce-only kitchen out of Oakland, California. And I thought we were just going to talk about his restaurant, but it turns out his views on economics, on justice, on food justice, on food, on health, are stratospheric, really all-encompassing. We have a great conversation, and I invite you to stay tuned for that one as well. So if you like the Plant Yourself podcast and you want to help out, the best thing you can do, aside from sharing it on social media and emailing episodes to friends who you think would appreciate it, is to go to iTunes and leave a nice review and give it some stars so that other people can find it as well. The more chatter there is on iTunes about podcasts, the higher they go in the rankings for people who are searching. So that's how you can help spread the word. If you're in the area, if you're in the North Carolina Triangle area and you'd like to come meet me, I hold dinners once a month. They're free. You just have to make reservations for you, for family, for friends. Numbers are limited because I am doing the cooking. But we talk about plant-based nutrition, but we do it in the context of a broader healthcare system. I'm part of a network with the Wellness Forum out of Columbus, Ohio, trying to provide people with the tools they need to make their own decisions about health. And if you are plant-based, you know that most doctors have never heard of this and would never recommend it. And that dynamic goes on not just with food, but with lots of other things. So if you're interested, if you know someone who is a victim of the medical system, who just follows doctor's orders, even if those orders happen to be asinine, if you know someone who would like to take their health back and achieve actual wellness and not just medicated and managed disease, then go to plantyourself.com/dinners to find out the schedule of dinners that will be held here in the North Carolina Triangle area. If you want to find out this information, you live far away, stay tuned. I'm going to be hosting a series of webinars. You'll have to cater them yourself, but the information will be the same. Music for today's show was kindly provided by Will Ridenour, a kora player from Greensboro, North Carolina. You can find more about Will at his website, Will Ridenour, that's WILLRIDENOUR.com, and also you can see the selections I chose in today's show notes. So with that, I wish everyone a happy growing season if you're in the Northern Hemisphere, and as always, be well, my friends.
Let's take this home with some gratitudes. First of all, thanks to Mama Earth. You have been so very, very good to me. Second, Will Ridenour donated the use of his beautiful song, Sabali Dawn, as the theme music for this show. You can find out more about Will's music at willridenour.com. Third, thanks to all the patrons of the Plant Yourself podcast for your financial support. You can read the names of all the patrons at any show notes at plantyourself.com. If you would like to become a patron to show your gratitude for the work I'm doing and help support it, you can do so at plantyourself.com/gift. That's G-I-F-T, all lowercase. And finally, I want to thank you, the listener, for making all of this possible, for giving me a reason to reach out to people, to have conversations, to edit, produce, publicize. All the stuff that I do is for you so that we can continue to have conversations and continue to ripple out healing and transformation into the world.